Capital Region, this is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting on WOOC LP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOS LP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOA LP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAA LP 107.3 FM Albany. From the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, I'm Eric.
And I'm Trayvon. Up first, New Yorkers. New York groups call on the state to redistribute wealth.
Then, personal finance basics with a local bank manager.
And later on, local entrepreneur Brianna Nichols is on the show.
After that, part one of Fire and Freedom with Historia Levada Nihon.
Finally, this week's Farmcast welcomes the Executive Director of Holistic Management International.
Let's jump into some headlines. The Boy Scouts of America has filed for bankruptcy as the century-old organization faces some 300 lawsuits from men who say they were sexually abused as scouts. The Boy Scouts of America said it was, quote, exploring all options available so that we can live up to our social and moral responsibility to equitably compensate victims who suffered abuse during their time in scouting, while also ensuring that we carry out our mission to serve youth, families, and local communities through our programs.
On Tuesday, the town of Petersburg in eastern Rensselaer County decided not to sign a state DEC consent order related to the cleanup of their polluted landfill, which has contaminated the local water supply. The state has indicated it will declare the landfill to be a Superfund site and seize control of the cleanup if the town fails to act. Environmentalists oppose the pending overall settlement, which includes payments from corporate polluters because it would cap the polluters' liability for damages and cleanup. They also criticize the DEC for waiting 20 years to take action on the landfill.
A Democratic Party primary appears to be looming to find a challenger to incumbent State Senator Jim Todisco of Schenectady. Thierce McCallman, who nearly knocked off Mayor Gary McCarthy in last year's Democratic primary, is now seeking the Democratic nod for the 49th State Senate District. Schenectady County Democrats have endorsed newcomer Donovan McGray of the Stockade District.
The Daily Gazette reports that a third batch of proposals have been announced for the state-funded $10 million downtown Schenectady Economic Revitalization Initiative. The city itself has proposed several infrastructure projects, including reopening the shuttered North J Street Tunnel in Little Italy and the mothballed alcohol tunnel. Projects also include a proposed aquatic center and separate retail complex at the Mohawk Harbor, each having a $30 million price tag. Other proposals are smaller and more arts-oriented.
The Troy City Council is giving up to $1,000 toward neighborhood improvement programs. The NIP projects range from neighborhood beautification efforts, gateway projects, public art and public gardens, veterans memorials, handicap swings, plantings, and other quality of life improvements. Applications and guidelines are available on the city clerk's website. The deadline to apply is April 13th.
The New York State has issued its final regulations for the statewide ban on plastic bags, and it contains the controversial proposal to allow plastic bags if they are thicker than 10 mils. DEC dropped the proposal to allow it to create exempt categories from the law. It also made it clear that only prepared carry-out food orders would be exempt at restaurants, food service establishments. The statewide ban on plastic bags takes effect March 1st. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, coming to you live from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or follow us on Instagram or Twitter at mediasanctuary and on Facebook at facebook.com/mediasanctuary. For our first segment, a coalition of groups rallied outside the legislative hearing to say that it was time to tax the rich to support more programs for average New Yorkers. We hear from Charles Kahn of Strong Economy for All, Rosemary Rivera, co-executive director of Citizen Action, and Sochi Nameka, director of Working Families Party. You will also hear a member of the group Vocal NY, Jasmine Gripper, head of Alliance for Quality Education, and Ron Deitch of Fiscal Policy Institute. This is part one by Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
On February 13th, a number of groups held a press conference outside of the state budget hearing, on taxes to say it was time to tax the rich. We hear first from Charles Kwan of Strong Economy for All.
Tax the rich,
not the poor.
Tax the rich,
not the poor.
In about, you know, an hour, our legislators in Albany are going to have a hearing about revenue, about resources. And every year in New York State, between January and April 1st, our legislators make decisions that add up to $175 billion. Ooh. It's where most of the money in New York State, it's where it's decided where it's going to go. And for too long, our communities have gotten screwed. We've gotten left out. The governor has forced austerity. He's forced stinginess on our communities.
That ain't right.
And we've suffered.
Yes, we have.
In that time, we've seen record numbers of homelessness.
That ain't right.
It's not right.
That ain't right.
The MTA is still broke.
That ain't right.
The potholes in the road will still send your car to the mechanic every time.
That ain't right.
We still don't have a Green New Deal.
That ain't right.
And communities of color are still left behind.
That ain't right.
And it didn't happen by mistake.
No, it didn't.
It happened by design.
Speak on it.
And we're not here by mistake.
Right.
We're here by design.
Yeah.
That's right.
Because we know that we need to fight right now what our communities need.
That's right.
And across this state, but mostly in New York City, there are record numbers of billionaires.
Come on.
112.
Speak.
520.
Buffalo.
18 in Buffalo.
Yes.
$525 billion of wealth. There are record numbers of millionaires. And we'll hear that, oh, they're going to leave. But since we put forth a millionaire's tax, we've seen 72% more. We'll also hear that New Yorkers are leaving. But we talk about who are the New Yorkers. Because we have more rich people.
Come on.
We got more millionaires, more billionaires.
Yeah. Right.
When New York's shrinking. So who's leaving?
Yeah.
It's our people. It's poor people. It's working people. Yeah. It's middle class people. They're all joined by folks from around the state that fight on a number of issues. Right, because we're joining together, because we know that they'll try and separate us, they'll try and force us into a mentality of scarcity, so that we fight with each other instead of fighting for where the money's at.
That's right.
So up first, we have my friend, all of them are my friends, actually, my friend, New York WFP Director, Sochi.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon,
brothers and sisters. My name is Sochi Nemeka. I'm the New York Director of the Working Families Party. So the Working Families Party was created to support and elect truly progressive democratic champions. We're talking about leaders who are not afraid to take on big money. We're talking about leaders who will fight for strong public schools, who will fight for fair wages so our working families could live lives of dignity and accessible quality healthcare for all of us. That's why all of us here elected a progressive slate of leaders just in 2018. We did that.
That's right.
And that's why we're here today to demand a budget that delivers for working people and makes the wealthiest in our state pay more.
That's right.
I hope folks are clear. The rampant inequality that we see here in New York is a moral crisis.
Right?
We're not just talking about numbers or figures or balance sheets. We're talking about decisions, choices, morality that right now is being balanced on the backs of us, black, brown, poor, working class people, and kids.
Speak on it.
The stock market is soaring.
Yep.
Our public schools are sorely underfunded.
Right.
And a state, as our brother just said, with the most millionaires than anywhere in the country, thousands of students are commuting to school every day from homeless shelters.
That ain't right.
Our classrooms are overcrowded. We cannot pay healthcare costs as they continue to rise. Countless New Yorkers are being pushed out of their homes, homes that they've been in for generations, or bouncing from rental to rental. This is by design.
Yes.
This is not an accident.
That's right. Speak on it.
Yep.
For too long, we talk about Republicans, but as Republicans and our friends, corporate Democrats, right, who are asking us to vote for them, who are asking them to support them, who are refusing to talk to their donors, ask wealthy people to actually pay more.
Co-Executive Director of Citizen Action of New York, Rosemary Rivera.
Everybody, my name is Rosemary Rivera, Co-Executive Director of Citizen Action. Today, I really want to direct my message to the legislators here in New York State. I don't know what drives them to public service. Mm-hmm. I don't know their triumphs, their dreams, their sorrows, or their struggles.
All right.
But one thing I do know is the everyday person.
All yeah. right.
I know that the struggles that I have faced are shared with millions,
come on,
with
come
most
on.
Of us here.
That's right.
My story is not unique.
Nope.
The only thing unique about it is that I am actually here and blessed to be here to share that.
Come on.
I think about the struggle of so many New Yorkers, and here I need a little help from all of you.
Come on.
I want you all to visually see it or hear it. If you've ever faced anything like this in your struggle, in your everyday struggle, after I read that sentence, I want you to say, taxed rich. Mm. Say this. If you've ever been homeless or evicted or just didn't know where you were going to lay your head.
Taxed rich.
Say this. If you didn't know where your next meal was coming from.
Taxed rich.
Say this. If you or someone you love is impacted by mental health.
Taxed rich.
Say this if you've ever received a shut-off notice from the gas and electric company.
Tax rich!
Say this if you were so stressed by trying to make ends meet that you yelled at your child the minute that they wanted that new toy in the store window.
Tax rich!
And say this if you worry about childcare and how it will impact your ability to keep or get a job.
That's the rich.
And give
you one. That's right. Mm-hmm. And say this if you have to worry about how you're going to pay for.
Next, we hear from a member of Vocal New York.
I'm just a soldier. I'm just a soldier in this fight, you know, and I'm glad to be among them. And I just want to say that last year we won bail reform, and this year we're fighting to keep it. We're not just here to bring the noise. We come with a mixed bag of solutions to assist our government in being more responsible and more responsive to our needs. Now, I lost a good job and possibly a career because I couldn't make bail for possession of a small amount of cannabis.
Speak on it.
Now, the fact that Republicans, police, and prosecutors are battling to roll back our gains, some Senate Democrats open to repeal of bail reform, even though the racist rollback and may plan and has been based in manipulation and flat-out lies.
Jasmine Cripper, Alliance for Quality Education.
Every year, state leaders tell our children there's not enough money for their education. When there was a financial crisis, they literally balanced the budget on the backs of our kids. They borrowed billions of dollars from education, meaning they cut funding from our schools.
Are they right?
When the economy recovered, we now have more billionaires than ever before. They still keep telling me they don't have enough money to fund our schools. How could that be the case? If budgets are about priorities, then the wealthiest nation, when the wealthiest state, has enough money to fund schools. There's enough wealth in New York State to make sure every child has a high-quality education in every zip code, in every community, no matter what their immigration status is.
Not the poor.
Tax the rich.
Not the poor.
We now hear from Ron Deutsch, Executive Director of the Fiscal Policy Institute.
A lot of our conservative critics are going to say today in that room that we've got a spending problem here in New York, not a revenue problem. I say they're right. We got a spending problem that we're not spending nearly enough.
Right?
The last 10 years under Governor Cuomo, we've been living under this 2% state spending cap, this self-imposed 2% state spending cap. This can talk about an ultra-millionaire's tax. We can talk about taxes on luxury second homes or third homes over $5 million. And you know who's on our side? 90% of the public, according to a poll that was released on Monday. 90% of the public is in support of doing these three things. And then we hear from our leaders that they're a little afraid about doing these type of taxes on the wealthy, right? But the other thing in the poll that they should recognize is that 72% of the public would be more likely to vote for them if they supported all of these tax increases on the wealthy. So now is not the time to be timid. Now is the time to meet the unmet needs that have been going on in the state for a very long time, that people have been turning a blind eye to.
So what we're going to do?
This has been Mark Dunley for Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. This has been part one of our coverage of the February 13th press conference on Tax the Rich.
We just heard from Charles Kahn of Strong Economy for All, Rosemary Rivera, co-executive director of Citizen Action, Sochi Namika, director of Working Families Party and a member of Vocal New York, Jasmine Gripper, head of Alliance for Quality Education, and Ron Deutsch of Fiscal Policy Institute. This was part one.
Up next, a local banker explains some nuts and bolts of personal finances.
This is HMM correspondent Alexis Goldsmith, and my guest today is Crystal Nelson, who is the branch manager for Berkshire Bank on Latham Schenectady Road.
Hi.
Crystal, can you tell our listeners how you became a branch manager at such a young age?
It was a series of very lucky events. I came out of sales, you know, shark sales, the fun sales. And I came in actually as a UFSR, which is a Universal Financial Service representative. And that's basically a teller slash banker. I got really lucky in my first 2 weeks and I did what I think was pretty well. And they promoted me up to a official financial service representative. And I stuck there for a little while. I did my best to just be the best that I could for my customers and make sure people were getting the right products. And when the opportunity came along to become an assistant, I applied. I even put together little charts to show the growth of the branch that I was in, which was a little bit more than they asked of me. And about 6 months later, I got lucky again, and there was an opportunity to become a manager. And I had a really great boss and have a really great boss who believed in me. And that's how we landed here.
Had you always been interested in economics?
No, so not at all. Nobody ever thought that I was going to end up working with numbers or finance at all. I was more of an arts kid. I was a theater kid for sure. So numbers was a surprise to everyone.
So what's been the biggest takeaway that you've learned from your time in the financial sector?
I think that when I started banking, I thought it was going to be this stuffy, boring, slow job. And that's not what it is at all. I didn't realize that I was going to have the opportunity to help people and sit down and get to know people the way that I have, and really just be a part of these people's lives. I have customers who I would consider almost family at this point, and I didn't think that's where banking was going to go.
So what do you do for people on a day-to-day basis?
Well, you know, there's the basic teller work, deposits, cashing checks, that type of thing. But then there's a handful of customers who come in every day who are just saying, you know, Crystal, I'm dealing with this right now in my life and I'm struggling in this area. And sometimes it's finance and I can sit down and go through their budgeting with them. And then sometimes it's just like something personal they just want to talk about. And I can be that person to sit and talk with them.
Wow, I would have never guessed a bank manager being like a confidant.
Yeah, you'd always think a hairstylist is the counselor, but no, it's the bankers.
So as the bank manager, and knowing what you do inside the financial sector, what do you think, like me, just as a regular person who has no idea about how all this works, what should I know about my finances?
The biggest thing is you should know what you're spending money on. A lot of people, they don't budget. They don't plan out how they're spending their money. They just spend it and, you know, they're living paycheck to paycheck. And a lot of people are. And sometimes you can't help that. But a lot of times there's little things that you can cut back on. Like I personally am guilty of buying a cup of coffee every single day and that adds up. So I would say for somebody not in finance or for people in finance, go over your spending. Look at what you're actually spending and what you should be spending and set a budget for yourself.
And what advice would you give for saving for the future?
So that's funny. I'm currently saving. And again, go through your budget. Make sure that you're paying off your credit cards every month. You're not spending more than you have to. Set a certain amount into, I would say, an emergency fund, and then set a separate amount into an actual savings fund so that if something happens, you don't have to empty your savings to fix whatever problem arose. You can actually just have your emergency fund. That's what I would say for saving for the future. So you have your emergency fund to, in case something happens, and then you have your actual savings account that you can leave and set and forget about. You know, just don't even pay attention to that fund.
What about borrowing to save for the future, saying taking on a mortgage to buy a house?
So the typical mortgage is a 30-year mortgage. Interest rates obviously vary. My biggest piece of advice is if you can make one extra payment a year, you're going to pay off your mortgage a lot quicker. As far as saving for a house, you should try and save at least 20% before you actually buy a house. A lot of people will buy a house and put down less than that, and it's going to be a lot harder for you in the long run if you do that.
Talk about the interest rates right now. Is now a good time to invest in a house?
Right now, the interest rates are ridiculously low on mortgages, so a lot of people are buying houses. My biggest thing with that is just be careful. Make sure you're buying a house that's really within your budget. Don't overbuy because your interest rate is lower and you'll be spending on interest. Still try and stay in that budget.
Is there a possibility that if we go into a recession that those interest rates could go up again?
Yeah, there's always a possibility of that. I mean, when you buy a house, you're getting an interest rate, and it depends on where you get the loan, whether it's a fixed interest rate or a variable one. But if it's a fixed interest rate, you don't have to worry about your mortgage rate going up. And generally, that's what a mortgage rate would be. But if you're going to buy a house, now is a good time because, you know, in 10 years, you don't know, or even 5 years, you don't know, the interest rates could be way higher if we're in a recession.
What is your impression of the stability of the local economy?
The local economy, right now it seems like it's in kind of a plateau. It seems to have stabilized where it's at. The election year is always odd. Again, I would just say there's a lot that could change in the next couple of years. It could either go really great or really bad. That's a tough question. It's a tough question. Just be careful. That's what I could say on that. Just be careful with your finances. Make sure you're saving and make sure you're making smart, sound investments.
How does one make a smart, sound investment in this day and age where if you want to get a mutual fund to save for the future, and that mutual fund is almost guaranteed to be investing in fossil fuels, for example. Is there a way to invest in the future that is not within fossil fuels or that is going to be more stable than that market?
So you should do your research on who you're investing with. The first bank that comes along and says, I can give you this rate, don't necessarily jump on that. If you want to make a good investment that's responsible as far as like not doing fossil fuels or anything, not investing in that type of thing, there are financial institutions that promise you that they are investing their money in specific things, and some of them specifically say, we do not invest in fossil fuels, we do invest in clean energy, we do invest in that type of thing. So you don't necessarily have to do something that's putting your money into a stock or into the stock market. There's things like CDs, long-term CDs, or fixed annuities or IRAs that you can put your money into. You just have to be willing to put it there and not touch it.
So if you want to learn about, you know, how to handle your personal finances, how to save for the future, for retirement, where does one find a financial advisor? How do you recommend one?
So I would say if somebody comes up to you and says, I'm a financial advisor, maybe don't go to that person because oftentimes there's financial advisors who are just looking to get you to invest in some kind of product that they're selling. The first thing you could do is find a bank that you trust and go to your banker and ask them, is there somebody I can go to talk about my finances? 10 out of 10 times, they have five options, or they can say, this person's not with this bank, but I know them and they're really great. So go to your bankers. They know more than you think they do.
Well, Crystal, thank you so much for joining us today.
Of course.
That was Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Alexis with local Berkshire Bank manager Crystal Nelson.
For those just tuning in, I'm Eric.
And I'm Trayvon. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, WOOC 105.3 FM Troy, WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady, and WOOA 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAA 107.3 FM Albany.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org or get in touch with us through email at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
Professional makeup artist Brianna Nichols sat down with Hudson Mohawk Magazine producer Melissa Bromley to share her craft.
Up in high school, I went to Columbia and I did the vocational program for 2 years within my junior and senior year. I came out of high school with a license and could go into a salon. And then I decided hair wasn't really for me. So then I fell in love with makeup, and because you can do something different every single day.
But you already had the skills to be doing professional makeup at that point?
I did not. I went to a school called Coswick School of Makeup Artistry in Fort Lauderdale, Florida for a year. And I learned from beauty, fashion, runway, how to make prosthetics to special effects makeup.
Cool. How long have you been doing all this for?
Around 3 years now.
Can you tell us a little bit about the kinds of projects that you take on?
I currently am going for the 798 union, the hair and makeup union. So that means I need 180 call sheets within 3 years. And I take on a lot of projects for TV and film, short films, do independent films, tier zero films, which is all considered by budget. So I've done special effects from in Troy, actually. That was actually one of my biggest movies that I have done around 2 years ago. So,
what movie?
It's Shoplifters of the World, produced by Joe Manganiello.
Cool.
Yeah.
I apologize for the little baby noises in the background. What kind of special effects makeup have you done?
I know how to do prosé transfers and foam prosthetics. So cuts, bruises, heads flying off to blood work tubing up the chest so you can have a bullet wound, anything like that.
Cool. Do you take those skills with you to Halloween parties?
Yes, I do. I actually do have a lot of people that do cosplay that will hire me to do their makeup. I did do a huge, it was like a kind of like devil, very, I'm not really sure what kind of makeup it was that he really wanted, but it was a huge prosthetic on the face, and it took about 5 hours to do.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Wow.
So you have to lay the prosthetic, paint it, put it all together, and it took around 5 hours. So.
And so are you still using the hair skills that you had?
I use hair skills often, yes. I'm mostly onset hair now, so anything dry to cutting dry hair, styling, blow drying, and it all is because I'm creating character as a whole, so with their hair and makeup, and then the wardrobe department as well, creating that style and putting it all together. It really like to make the vision come true for the director and for the script that they wrote.
Cool. I didn't realize that there was a market for professional hair and makeup for cosplay, but that makes sense.
They have a lot of conventions, actually, in Saratoga. I've seen one in Clifton Park. I bet there is more in Troy, too, that I just don't know about because a lot of people come from all over, but there is big conventions around here.
And so as you're growing your business, what direction would you like to, what kind of work would you most like to be doing?
I would most likely be on set, and I like to be hair and make, mostly makeup department head, which is me creating looks and having key and additional makeup artists underneath me. I create the initial looks, and then they would keep doing them every day, depending on which script day we are on.
And you mentioned being prepared to join a union. Can you talk more about how that works?
Yeah, so the local 798, you go in and you, over 3 years, need 180 call sheets. And if you don't know what a call sheet is one day on the film and your name on the back of it with the whole entire crew. Huh. And a call sheet tells you what scenes you're doing that day and when. In what order? So you need 180 call sheets over 3 years, and you pick hair and makeup, and then they will negotiate your rates, and they protect you, say, if a company goes bankrupt, and you still get paid for the amount if it goes under. So. Wow.
And so the sort of private clients that you work for wouldn't count for that, for those call sheets?
No, just on set or commercials. Anything that is videotaped, I would say, anything that's on screen is a call sheet.
So for folks who are listening who might want to hire you, how can they find you?
They could find me at www.briannanicholsartistry.com, Brianna Nichols Artistry on Instagram. I'm very big on Instagram, very big on Facebook. Sure. So that's mostly how you can find me.
And if there are listeners who are interested in getting into this kind of business themselves, do you have advice for them?
I definitely do. Know that you're getting into a industry that you truly have a passion for, because it's a lot more than just doing makeup. I'm such a more of a businesswoman than I ever thought I would be. I'm very much a small business. I travel often. Know that you keep learning every single day from other people, and you just, it's definitely striving to be the best person every single day. So I would definitely say you find a mentor. You practice every day, and it's a lot of free work in the beginning as well, just so you know. So you always have another job while pursuing this dream until you become full-time.
And so what has been the biggest challenge for you as you're building your business?
Biggest challenge for me would be, that's a very good question. I think knowing that I had no idea I was going to be such a businesswoman when it comes to taxes and invoicing. And I mean, I didn't know how to make an invoice, and I had to teach myself from YouTube, you know, writing checks to becoming a DBA. You know, I did not have a clue that I had to do any of this just to follow my dream of doing actual makeup on set. So that would definitely be a very, you know, that's been the hardest.
Sure. Is there like a particular look that you can think of that's been your favorite, and why?
My favorite look was a body painting that I did, actually. And it was from the show Teen Wolf, and it was a half lizard man that I did, and it took 4 hours, and it was one of the best produced things that I've ever done. So you can actually see it on my Instagram. It's about 2 years ago, but I still go back to that picture all the time when I need inspiration for myself. So
what made it so special?
The fact that I was using an airbrush, and that's when I fell in love with my airbrush as well. The different colors, the technique. I actually used fishnet stockings and cut them up to get the lizard look, and like then scales. Airbrushed over it, yeah, with a very silvery metallic color as well. So he really looked like he was popping out and coming to life.
Are those techniques that you sort of brainstorm on your own, or is that stuff that you find by Googling how to make scales?
That's actually something that I came up with by myself. I was at, you know, the craft store, and I saw the fishnet stockings. I was like, wow, if I stretch this out and then I airbrush over that, you know what that's going to create? So that's what I did, and I think that's probably why I'm so proud of it as well.
That was Hudson Mohawk correspondent Melissa Bromley with local entrepreneur Brianna Nichols.
The Hudson Mohawk Magazine, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine Network, roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry attended the Hudson Valley Community College Voices, a library lecture series on fire and freedom and enslavement in the early America, a traveling exhibit on February 5th. In this segment, he spoke with historian Lavada Nahan as she compared the depiction of Mount Vernon and the unique food culture of colonial New York in the times of enslavement in colonial Virginia. This is part one.
Correspondent for the Hudson Mohawk magazine, and I'm here at Hudson Valley Community College Voices lecture series, where they just had a speaker, Lavada Nahan, interpreter of the African American history, park recreation and historic preservation. And she talked about fire and freedom, food and enslavement in early America. And I have her as my guest. How you doing?
Thank you, Willie. Willie, thank you very much. I'm doing well.
Right. Now, just want to ask you about this exhibit, Fire and Freedom. Why is it necessary to point this out at this time, and what is the importance of food and enslavement in early America?
Well, excuse me, it's important for a number of reasons. The exhibit itself is based on Mount Vernon, George Washington's home, and my mission as the new interpreter of African American history for the state of New York's Bureau of Historic Sites is to bring New York history forward. There is no part of food that enslaved Africans and Africans born in America did not have something to do with, whether that was working in the fields, whether that was grinding the grain, dealing with the animals, from the husbandry to the slaughter, to cooking it, to serving it, to cleaning up after it. Every aspect is around enslaved labor. And that is not only happened at Mount Vernon, but that was happening here in New York. Enslaved Africans and Africans born here in New York were the dominant labor force. And we need to be aware of that, because we keep looking to the South. And in doing so, we're negating the thousands of men, women, and children who were enslaved here in our state. And I think that they sort of have had enough of our ignoring them.
Now, notice you did, like you said, you concentrated on George Washington and the estate in Vermont. And George Washington was a slaveholder.
Yes.
Right. And you also talked about when he died, he freed only his driver.
His valet.
His valet. And the rest of the people that he enslaved, they stayed enslaved.
Yes.
So what was some of the resistance that slave cooks and house slaves did in terms of, you know, because I know slavery, they didn't like being a slave.
No,
you know,
they didn't.
And I know there was a lot of resistance. And I think it was a Malcolm X who talked about the house Negro and the field Negro. And like though the house Negro called it didn't resist a lot, they went along. But in your presentation, and looking at the food, there was some resistance.
Well, one of the things that we always have to keep in mind, Willie, that yeah, there was resistance. But for every mistake, there was a whip. You know, we want to negate that. But when you entertain in your home, remember, this is pre-restaurant culture. So if you have family visiting, if you have friends visiting, you're not taking them out to a restaurant. You're entertaining them in their home. It is a way for people to show their wealth and their pride. For a cook to make a mistake, for a cook to put a bad dish on the table, she will be punished for that. Period. And she will still have to do her job. And resistance could be around breaking some tools or slowing down your work or escaping. Resistance happens. But for every time you resist, you do so consciously knowing that there is consequence. And we have to accept that consequence. And that consequence could also happen over a mistake. We know that on many of the manors, the equivalent of the southern plantations that are here in New York, you have young boys serving these meals. What happens if they accidentally drop a dish and it breaks? What happens if they spill wine on someone? What happens to them? Are they not punished because they happen to be a child? No, they're whipped. They're whipped. We always have to keep that in mind. There are challenges every day, all day. And those challenges are real. And I read those descriptions day in, day out. So we need to accept the consequence. But one of the things that we also need to do is accept the personal pride of the enslaved when they do something well. And one of the challenges, particularly around culinary work, is as the African-American community need to start looking at how we feel about images or depictions of enslaved smiling. I've cooked on those hearts. I've made that food. There is personal pride in a job well done. That smile is automatic. And we have to allow them to have a full range of human expression. We can't keep them buried in the pain, or they would have been crazy. There would have been thousands and thousands of crazy people running around. So how do you maintain sanity? That is done by bringing in the higher emotions of love, of joy, of a breath, of personal pride, of pride in your fellow person, your fellow enslaved person, because they've done something well. And we have to give them credit for that. We have to start really making them and embracing them as full human beings. Or we continue to do what we blame others about. We continue to dehumanize them. They are surviving and they are thriving. And we have to make space for them to thrive.
Mm-hmm. Well, like you said, when we think about slavery, we think about the South, you know, and the plantations on the South. And people normally don't think about, you know, the North.
Right, and I want them to think about the North.
Right.
I want them to think about the middle colonies. Right,
right. That's the point I wanted to ask you. What is that middle colony? Because I wasn't clear on that one.
Okay, so the colonies, there are 13 colonies. The colonies below Delaware from Maryland down are either started by the Spanish or they're started by Britain. Mm-hmm. Colonies from Massachusetts north, again, started by Britain or they're started by the French. Mm-hmm. The middle colonies from Delaware River up to the Connecticut River is actually started by the Dutch. So that land is called New Netherland. So those are the middle colonies. It becomes New York, mm-hmm. New Jersey, Delaware, Northern Pennsylvania, and Southern Connecticut. Because we are started by a company, right? It's all about profit. It's all about a different structure. But also, it is a different growing zone. When we look at, for instance, it is very common for people to say soul food. Soul food does not come into New York until we get into the Great Migration. And we have Southern slaves coming into this area. Because there are a lot of foods that will grow in the South that will not grow in our region. We can't document them. We don't have their presence here. So we are losing our food culture and heritage in New York because of the waves of people that came up from the South. So they are assuming everyone ate collard greens. And they didn't. They didn't grow collard greens here. They grew mustard greens. They grew turnip greens. That's what they're growing. So that shift doesn't happen until much later. So for many people, it is really important. We need to keep that regionality there. As a gardener, people are aware of that. Like if you go to buy a plant, you know, there's always, this is for zone 1 or this is for zone 8. Well, that's about the temperature. That's about the climate. And that climate affects the food that we eat. Wheat doesn't grow as well in the South as it does here. Yellow corn grows better around Texas than it does here. Like I'm from Texas, and one of the things that I notice is like a lot of people are embracing Juneteenth. Mm-hmm. And I keep looking for the Texas foods and I'm not seeing them. So the barbecue, well, barbecue in Texas is not predominantly pork. It's beef because it's hot. Pre-refrigeration is trichinosis in pork, right? Texas is settled by Germans. Where are the sausage? The sauces are different. You have the chili sauces coming out of Texas, where you have the vinegar sauces coming out of the East Coast, southern states. So there's regionality in the food. And we want to just say, oh, cornbread is cornbread. Well, it's not. I grew up with a dense, not sweet, yellow cornmeal cornbread. Mm-hmm. I come to New York, it's like eating cake.
That was part one of the HVCC series, Fire and Freedom and Enslavement in Early America, reported by Willie Terry. Up next, WOOC correspondent Mark Russo interviews Ann Adams, the Executive Director of Holistic Management Internationals. HMI educators work with farmers and landowners all over the world to improve the health of their land, their animals, and their businesses through better management.
Hi, Anne. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, Mark, for having me.
So tell me about your organization, what you do, and how it was formed.
Holistic Management International was formed in 1984. Our mission is to educate people in regenerative agriculture for healthy land and thriving communities. And we have a large network of certified educators and practitioners around the world. We've been training people over the years, so we estimate that there's probably close to 70,000 people that have been trained, and there's probably 100 million acres using these practices. And with holistic management, people sometimes are a little confused what that means, but really it's based on the concept that nature functions in wholes, and so we have to create a management system, particularly for natural resource and sustainable agriculture, regenerative agriculture, focused on that idea of how do we create the synergies and symbiotic relationships that really make a land come alive and have that soil be biologically active. And so we have a framework that focuses on a value-based decision-making process, because you have to look at the triple bottom line for a truly sustainable operation, and that includes the financial, the environmental, and the social. And so that three-legged stool is really what we're focused on in this management process.
So let's talk a little bit more about holistic management. What makes it different or more effective for dealing with these complex concerns like an environmental thing where there's so many variables?
Yeah, and that's really where I think this process is helpful, because we're looking at what is the environment do in terms of the function of ecosystem processes. You have the water cycle, the mineral cycle, the flow of energy from the sun through photosynthesis, and the biological community, and how do you build that diversity and that stability and that resilience. So if we look at a lot of systems of farming systems or other natural resource management systems, they tend to focus oftentimes on one aspect of, say, well, how do you get profit? And that's the only thing that's being focused on. And so the complexity is dealt with by bringing together all three of those legs that I was talking about, and really looking at adaptive management. I mean, people say, well, adaptive management has been around, but the ability to create adaptive management that is bringing in those three different components with the particular manager, because each context is different. You've got somebody in the Northeast that has a lot of rainfall, the land responds very differently than here in New Mexico, where it's very arid. And so you have to adapt to the environment. You have to adapt to the unique challenges that a producer might have or a land manager might have, and the community within which they function. So all those things have to play a part, and the framework helps people deal with that complexity more effectively.
So how does holistic management impact land management? We've been hearing a lot about plant-based proteins and a lot of the negative aspects of animals and agriculture. And I've been learning a lot about how beneficial animals can be if they're managed holistically and in a natural way. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. So with, you know, as people say, it's not the cow, it's the how. And so how are those animals, and I don't care if they're chickens, pigs, rabbits, or cows, that if you look at the long history of the amount of animals that used to roam this land, the way in which they would come in, provide a lot of fertilization, good disturbance of the soil, and then move on and allow for long recovery for those plants to grow again and their root systems to become strong again, we see that the fecundity of this landscape prior to humans being here was that natural system, and what kept that prey, those bison or elk or deer moving, was the predator. And of course, as humans, we've removed most of the predators that allowed for that predator-prey relationship to talk about a symbiotic relationship. The predator-prey leading to healthy grasslands because of those herbivores taking care of all the microbes in the soil, all the macrofauna in the soil, wasn't just an incredible thing that unfortunately humans broke with tillage, overgrazing, those kind of things. So as regenerative agriculture people involved in that, they're learning how to be a part of nature again in a good way and build the soil health through those animals coming in, providing that fertilization disturbance, and then moving on, allowing for that recovery. And we're seeing, you know, people trying things like no-till or multiple cover crops, and they're getting some great soil health. But where it really takes off is when they integrate livestock and the explosion of soil life because of that integration, that good integration of animal livestock coming in is just phenomenal. And what you're then finding is the amount of carbon sequestration in the soil, carbon coming out of the atmosphere and being sequestered in the soil, is so much greater, particularly at depths further down, because the plant is taking that carbon and bringing it out of the CO2 out of the atmosphere and as a root exudate going into the soil to feed the microbes. And that's where it's being held as this carbon sink. And so to me, I think that's one of the most exciting things is how we can address some of these key issues like excess carbon in the atmosphere and putting it back into the soil.
So for someone of our listeners who may have relationships with farmers who are just food interested people who are interested in becoming better food citizens or making better choices to support these kinds of farmers who are doing this kind of work, what are some things that they can look for at the farmers market or at the grocery store to indicate that they are spending money to support farmers who are using these practices?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I think it's so important to do that kind of thoughtful consumption to support these kind of producers. And the things that I look for, well, the first thing is to ask the producer, particularly at a farmer market, if you've got that kind of relationship, what are you doing? Have you measured your soil health? Those kind of things, out of curiosity, not anything kind of aggressive, but to be a part of the education process. And in terms of when you're buying online or in a store, is looking online for what are the actual production practices of these companies. Because a lot of these, like Thousand Hills Cooperative, they have certain principles that they articulate online that they have all of their producers have to use in order to sell into their cooperative. And so I think the more we can really look closely, because there's a lot of grass-fed meat or those kind of things out there that if you look more deeply, that grass-fed meat's coming from other countries. And so like the American Grass-Fed Association is a certification vehicle that helps people know that this food is coming from locally and in America, and has certain practices that will regenerate the landscape.
So it's delicious and nutritious and has a really broad impact. And I think that's a magical thing. Mm-hmm. Holistic management is a land management tool, but are there ways that it can be applied to things beyond farming? What's the sort of, how is it moving beyond just land management into sort of the broader, or what impact is it having on broader society at this point?
Right. Yeah, I'd say certainly the background is that farming, agricultural background. But because it's a value-based decision-making framework, anybody can use it. So there are a lot of people who are having other businesses. Oftentimes they are food-related businesses, but it doesn't have to be. There are people who are working with policy issues in different states and in different countries using this framework, because the idea is if we are moving towards what we want rather than reacting to a problem, the outcome is much greater. And if we're looking at root causes rather than symptoms and addressing those root causes, the framework helps us look at those things more deeply. And if we can motivate people because they feel like their values are being addressed, then we're more effective in the policies and practices that result from that analysis.
Great. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. If folks are interested in learning more about holistic management, where can they find more info online?
Our website is www.holisticmanagement.org, and there's lots of information there for people to learn more about.
Great, Anne. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Mark Russo with a Executive Director of Holistic Management International, Ann Adams.
And that concludes our show. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Eric.
And I'm Trayvon. Our engineer today is Erica. Remember to tune in every weekday to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get this daily dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have any comments, suggestions, or a tender confession, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org, or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.